I avoided the common for a few weeks and repaired my headphones with masking tape. But as the weather gradually got warmer, we started going there again on the way home. We, being me, Gaz and Dom, and self-confessed token girl, Days. Dom was into reciting routines from the Arena documentary on writer William S. Burroughs that someone in the college library had videoed when it was on telly a couple of months earlier, and which we must have seen a dozen times, not including the rewinding of favourite sequences, so knew those routines inside out in the way that school friends with older brothers knew Monty Python. Burroughs was, is, funnier. "Listen to my last words," Dom would say, imitating that voice. If you haven't seen the film, it's well worth checking out and easier to get hold of these days, of course, thanks to the brilliant Ubu web. At the time, it was a revelation. I'd never heard of Allen Ginsberg up to that point. Francis Bacon, yes, of course, and not least because part of the entrance exam for Foundation was to copy an old master in the style of a then contemporary artist, and lacking both imagination and knowledge, I'd done the Mona Lisa in the style of Bacon. There's a very brief interview fragment with Patti Smith near the beginning of the film. She's picking at her clarinet reed while describing Burroughs as being up there with the Pope, screaming or not, and that made me prick up my ears because I'd been into her stuff ever since one of our lodgers was given horses as a birthday present the week it came out. What blew me away, even more than the record itself, was driving home in my father's Bedford van one day, maybe later that year or early 76 when I'd have been 12 at best, and hearing Wilson Pickett's storming version of Land of a Thousand Dances on the radio. I'm not joking when I say that it was like a light went on in my head. It was electrifying. So that's what she did. This was the same common, Turbury if you know it, between Wallacedown Road and West Howe, where Dom and I at least, who both grew up in West Howe and went to the same schools all the way through, would have gone to play war when we were kids, or football. In the meantime, several new generations had dropped their sweet wrappers under the same bushes that we had years before, and so on. Found the mysteriously discarded pornography, learnt to navigate the crisscrossing main tracks, as well as what with local pride we'd used to call the smuggler's paths, because we thought that only we knew about them. In reality, these were well trodden, but still impenetrable enough to anyone who cared enough about their clothes not to get down on all fours and crawl beneath the hawthorn to reach the dusty floored and branch vaulted tunnels beyond, which was the whole point. The goalposts where we'd played those endlessly rotating games of Wembley or Three and In were still there, chalked and rechalked onto the high pink-bricked wall for someone else to play against. They're probably still there now. I can remember where the old tip was down by the plantation, even though it had been covered over even by then, and is now completely overgrown with elder. When I was really young, my cousin and I would go down there and dig for the old Victorian bottles that were lined up along my bedroom windowsill, where the blue, brown and green glass would catch the light. Funny the way that you begin to stake out a personality with things like Days with her Pre-Raphaelite posters and the Susie merchandising she'd got from Armadillo, or by what you listened to. And Armadillo was a great shop. For a couple of years, I had a nice little number handing out flyers for them every Saturday lunchtime, either for the shop or for Mix, short-lived club, Midnight Express. I'd given up by the time we were doing Foundation because I had a cleaning job at the college that the office kindly set me up with as a way of paying what I suppose would have been some kind of tuition fee or registration fee, but which from memory would have been about £50 and might as well have been £500. They deducted £5 a week from my wages. I couldn't have done the course otherwise. I'd enjoyed that old Saturday job, though, collecting a carrier bag of flyers from Mick or Eddie or whoever was on that Saturday, then making my way down to the Triangle, a cup of tea and a 00 egg. and then down towards the front or wherever the mood took me, which was generally to places where I thought I'd be most likely to see people I knew, hardly work at all. It was easy enough to get rid of the flyers too, because there was a massive music scene in Bournemouth at that time. We four wannabe art students had grown up steeped in this kind of heavily nuanced musical encyclopedia of disco, funk, punk, punky reggae, dub, ska, rocksteady, new wave, new romantic, soul, industrial, proto-goth, you name it, but felt happily unaffiliated. Too young or slow to have seen the Clash at the Chelsea Village, let alone Bowie, but old enough to be bored of hearing about the glory days from Phil, who doled out free local musical history with his merchandise. By the time the Common re-entered our consciousnesses, or speaking for myself anyway, it was as the shortcut that I took on my way to start sweeping sculpture studio floors at 7 in the morning. If I wasn't listening to You Roy's Natty Rebel on the Walkman, I'd be singing it. Said I'm a living man and I've got a lot of work to do. Later in the day, it would be the place we'd go to hang out and to smoke or drink, things we couldn't easily do at home. It was the same, but a bit different, physically smaller than my memory of it, but somehow psychically vast. There were always new worlds to be explored, conjured from whatever scraps we could find. A new 7-inch single, maybe, that would be played later, but in the meantime was pored over for clues. Music was how I found out about books, so if Laurie Anderson recommended Gravity's Rainbow or Gertrude Stein, I'd go away and read them. Scritti told us about Derrida, Patti Smith led to Rambo, Barrett to Joyce, and it would have been Throbbing Gristle that led us to Burroughs, and around then one of us would have had a paperback of Cities of the Red Night or a William Burroughs reader in their bag. His older stuff wasn't really available except at the library or in these strange 1970s paperback editions on pulp science fiction imprints, which I tracked down. I've still got the Panther paperback of Nova Express. If it was sunny, then Daisy's straw hat and a bottle of cheap white wine between us, or Dom announcing that he wanted to smoke some hashish, please, was enough to evoke some kind of Brideshead-style idyll. Little things, a sketchbook and some Conte crayons, jumble sale booty like Daisy's Super 8 camera, or her old green cloth-bound copy of the Observer's Book of British Wildflowers. Anything like that would be sufficient to complete the momentary assemblage of a fantasy bohemia that slowly became real life. It was, I suppose, the kind of earnest freedom that you feel you were carving out for yourself at that age. A golden moment that seems to be there for the taking and which lasts as long as your luck holds. There were new names on the wall over the back of Downey Close too by then, chalked or painted around the goalposts like a ghost legion. Nothing sophisticated, no tagging as such, it was too early for that, or spray work, just crudely daubed letters done with what looked like leftover house paint. Names like The Trouble Gang, or imaginatively, Chalky. That rang a bell. Aye, said Gaz, your friend. Dom had been particularly incensed when I told them what happened in the new year as I was walking across the common on the way back from a morning at college, daydreaming, listening to something heavy and hypnotic like The Gospel Comes to New Guinea on my Walkman. I'd barely noticed a couple of blokes walking the other way, but after they passed, one of them had turned and hit me over the back of the head with what could have been a bottle, because afterwards I found one on the ground next to me. All I knew about it was that suddenly I had dirt in my mouth and was looking at the imprint of a pony's hoof in the gravel a couple of inches from my face. I heard a voice say, "Leave him, Chalk. I don't think he's a proper skin." When they'd gone, I picked myself up slowly and wiped the dirt from my face, gingerly feeling through my hair for the bump, then looking around for my headphones. After that, Chalky became our code name for every soul boy whose gaze we avoided before never returning to whichever pub it was we were leaving in a hurry. Leave him chalk, we'd say, incorporating the threat of violence into our own satirical routines. If there was more than one of them in their thin-collared shirts and their burgundy pegs, we'd call them the Trouble Gang, after the graffiti by the goalposts. These were names that served for anyone who might beat you up because they didn't like the way you looked or because they could tell that you weren't into George Benson. Self-appointed truth teachers on their manky bikes. Subtle subcultural differences magnified further by which side of whichever main road you lived on, what kind of punk you were, Hampshire versus Dorset, Bournemouth versus Poole. Local differences like that were all quite close to the surface, looking back, although actually there was much more crossover than that makes it sound like. I'll happily dispel one particular myth of the ultimate crossover, though, and I can be absolutely 100% about this because I was there. What happened was that when we were coming back late one night, Dom had nicked a can of retouching spray from his dad's garage. And on that wall over Downey Close way by the goalposts, he sprayed up a massive capital T and a capital G with a lightning bolt down the middle. TG as in throbbing gristle. We were practically doubled over with glee and bursting with the noisy effort of not laughing, but we got away with it. Even more hilarious was that when we next went that way a week or so later, someone with a different colour paint had added letters vertically under the T and the G, so it spelt Trouble Gang. Dom is obviously not around to confirm this very sadly, but Gaz would back me up that he swore us to secrecy, and like I say, I'm absolutely 100% that he'd known this would happen, and that was why he'd done it. It was part of the plan, and anyone who remembers Dom will not be surprised when I say this, or that he did not leave it there. That wasn't Dom's style, unfortunately. He didn't really go for half measures. A few days later, and thinking about it now, it must have taken him that long just to prepare everything. He went back more properly equipped and did a whole TG graphic. The black square, red bar across the middle, white flash of lightning down the center. He put a smaller TG in bold white capitals at the 5 o'clock position. He was a great artist, Dom, and a perfectionist, so he made a really good job of it, painting the whole square white first, the way any artist would do, to give himself a good ground to work on for even cover and to get perfect whites in the finished piece. He used stencils and got that slightly off-register look, which made it really stand out. Then he took a Polaroid of the finished article, which he gave me the next day, and I've still got somewhere. I don't know who they thought was doing this, but one of their own, evidently, because during the weeks that followed, as spring turned to summer, the Trouble Gang's new graphic identity really caught on, and variations on that black and red square, the lightning flash, the T and the G, started appearing around the place, further afield than just that particular wall over Turbury. You'd see homemade stickers on bus stops or lampposts, that kind of thing. Trouble Gang. The lightning flash. Ah, aye, aye, Gaz would say. One thing with the Soul Weekender scene that was really taking off around then was that particular groups would really dress the part and maybe all go for a similar look, like all have bleached jeans and white t-shirts. Most of the white guys had wedges, though some went for a button-down preppy look with more of a plastered-down, grown-out suede head type of thing. Some of the bigger Soul Boy crews had names like One Way, who I think were from Farnham, but I could be wrong. The Funk Master Generals was another. They had logos and everything. The Soulful Street Rhythm Dancers had one that was copied from the London Underground. Magnum Force, all wore matching jeans with navy blue t-shirts to set their name across the top above a shield that looked a bit like the MG sports car badge. It wasn't my scene, I just know or knew all of this because, like I said, I used to give out flyers for a record shop, so I'd bump into these guys and they were really into their music like we all were, so of course I'd give them a flyer. You've probably already guessed that this type of crew identity was what the Trouble Gang aspired to. So Dom's little TG joke fell on ground that was a bit more fertile than Turbury Common. It's no surprise what the Trouble Gang had printed on their t-shirts. It hadn't even crossed my mind that it might have been Dom who actually made the shirts, but looking at it now, I wouldn't put it past him. It would have been easy to make up some screens in the print room. And he went to college early enough. He'd be there every morning around 8, hanging around, waiting for us student cleaners to finish. You had to if you wanted decent time on the equipment. It was a habit I picked up too, and I'm still an early riser as a result. Dom had been into printing even at school. At one point, he had practically got a cottage industry going in the production of Red Brigade t-shirts in the art room. And of course, he had have met the Trouble Gang through his sister Rach, who was maybe a year younger but a bit more mainstream in her mates and her taste in music, so quite into the soul scene. I vaguely recall that at one point she was either going out with one of the Trouble Gang or one of them fancied her or something. Oh God, I'm so stupid. Of course it was him. Dom, you sly bastard. Looking at it now, aside from the joke of it, the reversal, what he was kind of saying, I think, was, okay, if you're going to beat up my mate because of how he looks, then I am going to make you want to look like him. After Foundation, we all went our separate ways. Days to Farnham, Dom to what was still then called the Central School, Gaz to Winchester, me to Leeds, and pretty much lost touch till Gaz tracked me down via my mum with the bad news about Dom. Days I've no idea, but Gaz and me are now Facebook friends. But honestly, that is genuinely the complete genesis of the myth, which I still see repeated even now, and which, if you are reading this, you have probably heard too in the histories of Acid House. That there were Bournemouth soul boys who were so hardcore that they were into TG. The myth was unshakably reinforced by a couple of gurning pissheads with wedges who appeared in a Bournemouth funk scene photo that was published in the NME, illustrating what would most likely have been a sarcastic review of some Light of the World single, and who were wearing what to anybody else would have looked like Throbbing Gristle's second annual report t-shirts. This image got cited so many times by hardcore psychic TV fans and photocopied so often that I think the myth sort of came true. There were even t-shirts of that. Of course there were. I've had conversations with people about the beginnings of the UK rave scene who have repeated this to me in all seriousness, then taken their copies of the 1983 mute re-release of TG's 20 Jazz Funk Greats off the shelf, and by way of further final incontrovertible proof, they solemnly slide the record out of its inner sleeve to show me the message from George Peckham, also known as Porky, that is etched into the vinyl between the label and the lead-out groove of side one. Into funk first.